Peter Parry, whose lecture this evening is entitled What's Left in Postcolonial Studies.
Thank you, Neil. That was moving and overgenerous, but thank you all the same. Thank you, Rashmi, for introducing the event. Thank you, Saoirse, for organizing it. And thank you all for being here. I'm not given to punning, although this talk has punning title. I first met Edward Said when he was already a major figure in literary studies and went on to know him intermittently as a comrade. This was his choice of word, which he used without irony when speaking to and about those whose far-left affiliations he respected but did not share. Of his many and paradoxically aligned persona, this was the Edward with whom I was most at ease, and the one I still hear talking in my head, whose ideas and opinions I could find vexing, such as his credulity about the incentives to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, or his unwillingness to consider Mandela's complicity in installing neoliberalism as the creed, culture, and condition of the so-called New South Africa. But this was also the Edward who, in scorning the pretensions and timidity of the entrenched professoriate and castigating professional intellectuals for failing to undertake the dissenting functions of an intelligentsia, fortified those of us who were outsiders to what, until recently, constituted intellectual fashion. For some commentators, Said's authority was and remains literary, and indeed the argument that Said was primarily a philologist, I'm referring to one working in the tradition of left scholarship, that is both historical and textual. Brennan has been the subject of Timothy Brennan's impressive elaborations. I, however, want to consider the legacy of the years when Said knowingly brought politics to his academic projects. It was then that the social and ideological were intrinsic and not just context to his study of rhetoric, narrative, and form. It was at that time that he urged the responsibility of professional criticism to engage with matters of inequality, injustice, and oppression. As I see it, Said over the years made a circuitous journey between normative literary critical concerns, the integration of aesthetics and politics, and in his last years, a mode of dealing with the integrity of work, of a work that cannot be reconciled with the world from which it came, those are his words, and hence, in a certain sense, escapes historical determination. This movement gives me a sense that Said was not born a radical critic, and that his radicalism was achieved, or perhaps thrust upon him, as responses to wider temporal and intellectual predicaments. The first of these, I suggest, was recoil from the reactionary politics sweeping academia in the 70s, when the humanities and especially the burgeoning discipline of theory flaunted their disdain for left and materialist thinking. The other was an intensified consciousness of the Palestinian situation, and with this, a keen awareness of the affliction that visited on the dispossessed. I don't want to re-quote what Rashmi has already quoted, so let me try and skip. But he argued strenuously that the political world is animated by the realities of power, interest, and authority. This takes the intellectual from relatively discrete questions of interpretation to much more significant ones of social change and transformation. And he went on to produce a stream of essays and interviews intended to make visible, as Rashmi has quoted, the actual affiliations that exist between the world of ideas and scholarship on the one hand and the world of brute politics and military force on the other. Insisting that the representations produced by the intellectual are always tied to and ought to remain an organic part of an ongoing experience in society of the poor, the disadvantaged, the voiceless, the unrepresented, the powerless. Would that it were so. The moment of Said's overtly political writings preceded and stimulated the beginnings of post-colonial studies in English and comparative literature departments of the elite institutions in the US and later the United Kingdom during the early 80s. This turn has been accounted for by Neil Lazarus and Rashmi Varma in a credible account of the relation between the problematic of post-colonial studies and developments in the social world, between the genesis of the field and the environment created by the, I quote, savage restructuring of class relations worldwide under the sign of neoliberalism, a time when academics in large numbers were induced to either silently withdraw from or brazenly denounce left politics, and demoralized left-wing metropolitan intellectuals abandoned anti-capitalist ideologies, pronounced communism dead and Marxism invalidated. In such a milieu, Rashmi and Neil argue, post-colonial studies came to register a complex and contradictory response. On the one hand, its practitioners adjusted to a conservative climate by describing themselves as postmodern or post-Marxist. On the other, because they were launching a critique of Eurocentrism, they could, by the very nature of their pursuits, present themselves as theoretically ultra-radical. They are then, Neil and Rashmi suggest, two aspects to post-colonial studies as an academic enterprise, one accommodationist, the other subversive, an understanding shared by Timothy Brennan, who has described the field as constituting a schizoid combination of liberationist impulses and middle-class flight. The will to accommodation in post-colonial studies, I'm okay without the mic? The will to accommodation in post-colonial studies was and remains prominent. From the start, the most influential critics repudiated the Marxist analysis of imperialism and with it waived participation in a broader anti-capitalist critique, thus guaranteeing that the insurrectory rhetoric for which some came to be renowned was largely gestural, directed as this was at colonial discourse, and detached from the will to concede, to contest and supersede that totality within which colonialism had been engendered. Said's relationship with the post-colonial field was ambiguous. The publication of Orientalism in 1978 destined him to be named as the father of postcolonial studies, a paternity he energetically denied, but a designation he could not escape, since this book was crucial in the formation of the early stages of postcolonial studies in the form of colonial discourse analysis. However, Said's distance from the field's directions was registered in remarks such as his faulting cults like postmodernism, discourse analysis, new historicism, and deconstruction for giving intellectuals an astonishing sense of weightlessness with regard to the gravity of history. Yet in one significant instance, his own theoretical practice shared a propensity for misinterpreting that system of concepts and methodology that has done most to explain modern colonialism and imperialism as integral to capitalism's beginnings, expansion, and ultimate global entrenchment. This inclination was second nature to the founding postcolonial critics, who, like Said, were haunted by Marxism, and in their alleged problematizations and corrections of that tradition of thought, blunted criticism of the very object they had set out to analyze and censure, although for some, denunciation was compromised, as I will later suggest. Because of which, the necessary critique remains that of the unrenounceable Marxist project, in Perry Anderson's words, of advancing a totalizing comprehension of the new unlimited capitalism, a theory adequate to the global scale of its connections and disjunctions. Instead, Said, on the one hand, construed imperialism as a political dispensation imposed by a powerful West, not metropolitan capitalism, but a powerful West on the rest of the world, while postcolonial critics perceived a cultural or civilization encounter to which othering and identity formation were central. Both perspectives distracting from an inclusive understanding of the myriad structural and social ramifications of colonialism and imperialism. All the same, the substance and tone of Said's abjurations of Marxism were both more thoughtful and more contradictory. Whereas he acknowledged the dislike of all systems, he also conceded that he had been more influenced by Marxists than by Marxism or any other ism. And while he formally refused to recognize Marxism as inherently and inescapably critical, he during the 1970s and 80s made known his admiration for this very quality in the works of Lukács, Goldman, Raymond Williams and Adorno, whose writings he introduced to a generation of Columbia graduate students who at that time were without ready access to Marxist thought. As a public intellectual, Said despised accommodation with what he called the constituted and authorized powers of one's own society, and was contemptuous of that generation of artists and intellectuals who in America and in England had volunteered to serve in the Cold War. In his books, he instead embraced figures like Aimé Césaire, Frantz Fanon, C.L.R. James, Iqbal Ahmed, Amilcar Cabral, Che Guevara, and Walter Rodney as comrades in the struggle against imperialism, and called attention to the failure of post-colonial critics to acknowledge that these anti-colonial Marxists had confronted the contradictions and hierarchies in the institutional thought of the metropoles long before they had got round to it. Yet none of these gestures of goodwill impinged on Said's misprision of dialectics. Brennan has argued that his now overused term, contrapuntal criticism, was an alternative to hybridity, conjuring images less of mixture and mutual complicity than of independently directed harmonizations and contacts. While for Radhakrishnan, it suggests a mode of reading consciously tracking back and forth across the activated imperial divide. I see it rather as an alternative to dialectics, which provokes the question of whether a musical metaphor alluding to a combination of two or more independent themes into an interrelated polyphonic composition can do the work of thinking about a conflictual process, which should surely require figures of dissonance rather than concordance. Ironically, when Said in Culture and Imperialism set out to, and these are quotes, to think through and interpret together experiences that are discrepant, and to understand the overlapping experiences of colonizer and colonized, these affirmations are repeatedly interrupted by observations of inequality, coercion, and contest, of what he calls the fundamental ontological distinctions, the absolute disparity in power, the withholding of mutuality, and the codification of difference. Thus, on encountering and confronting irreconcilable conflict, Said finds that running like a fissure through the imperialist ensemble is the principle of domination and resistance based on the division between the West and the rest of the world. History, Said adds, teaches us that domination breeds resistance and that the violence inherent in the imperial encounter, for all its occasional profit and pleasure, is an impoverishment for both sides. Such reversals put significant pressure on Said's usage of the contrapuntal as a means of theorizing the imperial connection. For in seeking for forms of commonality, he found instead discord. They also undermine the facile notion of complicity between colonizer and colonized that has become commonplace in post-colonial studies, where persistent efforts are made to find a middle ground between the terms domination and oppression, and to define colonial relationships as generically ambivalent, and to represent colonial occasions as always the site of dialogue, negotiation, and mutual empathy. Does Said then inadvertently undermine the explanatory potential of the contrapuntal? Or would it be a sleight of hand to suggest that this was an achievement in line with Adorno's affirmation that a successful work, according to immanent criticism, is one which expresses the idea of harmony negatively by embodying the contradictions, pure and uncompromised in its innermost structure? If so, why did Said remain resistant to the dialectic, even altering its meaning to insist that thought process routinely resulted in synthesis, resolution, transcendence, or aufheben? Because the model of thesis, antithesis, synthesis, as posited by Engels, Plekhanov, and Stalin, is not shared by all Marxists, and dialectics has been repeatedly elaborated and re-theorized, and because aufheben is a concept where negation and preservation denial and affirmation remain bound together, it denotes not concord, completion and closure, but the dynamics of further and endless contradiction. Why then should a formidably knowledgeable thinker misinterpret a methodology described by Lukács as a ceaseless generation and dissolution of intellectual categories, or, in Frederick Jameson's words, a cognitive mode that attempts to hold together a conceptual coordination of incommensurables within the framework of a single thought or language? Insisting that Marxism belonged with the German idealist tradition of synthesizing the antithetical, Said scanted the caveat of Adorno's negative dialectics and strategy of dialectical reversals, claiming Adorno as an unequivocal defendant of the rights of the aesthetic by dispensing with Adorno's understanding that the historicity of an artwork is a presence that is cancelled and restored. What then is at stake in Said seeking to detach Adorno from Marxism by disputing Frederick Jameson's location of his late style within Marxist thought? My reading of Adorno, Said wrote in 1995, with his reflections about music at its center, this is a quote, sees him as injecting Marxism with a vaccine so powerful as to dissolve the agitational force almost completely. Not only do notions of advance and culmination in Marxism crumble under his rigorous negative scorn, but so too does anything which suggests movement at all. What is to be inferred from this cryptic passage, where the use of a term relating to immunization against disease resonates a visceral recoil from an analytic category misconstrued by Said as practicing a smooth and straightforward progression in its thinking and predicting inevitable progress towards a desirable end state of harmony in the real world? Is he approving Adorno for draining Marxism of its agitational force and commitment to movement, or is he detecting a tension between Adorno as motionless, locked within the aesthetic, and as a revolutionary commentator who had protested against forms of cultural criticism that, in his word, had wrenched the mind out of a dialectic with the material conditions of life? These are intriguing questions I cannot answer, especially as Said elsewhere delivered glosses uncannily attuned to Adorno's thinking, as when he perceived that for Adorno, late-style Beethoven presides over music's rejection of the new bourgeois order. So too, Said fully grasped the implications of Adorno's rule of thumb that in the contemporary world, cultural forms that appear most distant from society, for example, the lyric and 12-tone music, are the best places to see the imprint as well as the distortions of society upon the subject. And Adornian insights entered Said's own reading of Lampedusa's The Leopard, where he understands the prince's consciousness of death, decay, and decrepitude as inseparable from social integration, the failure of the revolution, and a sterile and unchanging Italian self. Said's negligence in the formal disposal of dialectics, often countermanded in his practice, is of a different order from those post-colonial critics who consigned Marxist methodology to the funeral pyre and without observing the protocols of first examining the state of the designated corpse. And this, although some prominent figures named themselves as post-structuralist Marxists. I do not want to underestimate the range and importance of much work done under the emblem of post-colonial studies, such as exposing the grotesqueries in metropolitan discourses on societies peripheral to the core capitalist centres, or opening up the study of the cultures, cognitive modes, writings, literatures of all layers of these societies, for undermining received historical accounts, expanding the historiographical range, the historiographic range, and much else. However, what remains remarkable is that in the mainstream discussion is that an often used language of engagement and resistance is never tied to an engaged pursuit of a political argument directed at dismembering the rationale of the prevailing system. Moreover, I want to suggest that influential critical practices have promoted Otieno's revisions of colonialism and myopic perspectives on the post-colonial. As is well known, post-colonial studies in its theoretical orientation came to be identified with post-structuralism, and this in spite of Marxists and historical and cultural materialists contributing to the discussion. This alignment was actively promoted by prominent critics antagonistic to what they called orthodox Marxism as totalizing, Eurocentric, dependent on meta-narratives, etc. A rejection that as a consequence erased entire continents of the empirical and the conceptual from their maps of the world. Expectation of an interested student is to find discussion of pre- and post-independence material and social conditions, she and he will soon learn to look to the abundant inquiries that were and are conducted elsewhere in specialist domains within history, in the social and political sciences, and amongst the majorities in the field. Amongst the minorities in the field. Amongst the matters ignored in the mainstream of post-colonial criticism has been the impact of colonialism, or the impact of capitalism on the socio-economic forms and institutions of pre-colonial societies, the formation of classes, and the transformation of indigenous inequalities into class relationships, the effects of combined and uneven development structurally and socially on the making of peripheral modernity, and aesthetically on the making of peripheral modernism. The different ideologies and aspirations of the anti-colonial movements, the continuing domination of metropolitan capitalism, the class formations and conflicts in post-independence nation-states, the role of coercive neoliberalism, and the complicity of native compradors in the retreats of post-colonial regimes. All the same, Robert Young has recently praised the field as constituting a remarkable dispersal of intellectual and political influence, its perspectives having spread amongst disciplines, reaching into almost every domain of contemporary thought to become part of the consciousness of our era. And he goes on to describe post-colonialism as a wide-ranging political project that has always aspired to turn the power structures of the world upside down and to refashion the world from below.